Alright, so y'all have probably already heard a lot of the stuff that I'm supposed to say before we begin. So basically just try to be respectful, turn off your cell phones, buy stuff from Sunstone so you guys can have extra planets. And also if you guys can leave courteously afterwards. In this session, Nathan McCluskey and Gina Colvin will reflect on 24 years of their Mormon marriage, where some of their most persistent conflicts have been over levels of religious observance. Without any guarantee of assurance, they will discuss their past and current conflicts, negotiations, and resolutions as they decide how to manage their intrafaith future as a couple and family. Dr. Gina Colvin is a research fellow at the University of Canterbury, Christ Church, New Zealand, with an interest in cultural and post-colonial studies. She is an international editor for Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Nathan McCluskey earned his PhD from the University of Canterbury in political science. He now works as the union convener. I'm not familiar with that word, but he's doing that now for New Zealand's National Statistics Agency. Thank you.
It's been an interesting road getting to this point where we talk together about our intrafaith marriage. And so when I say no guarantees, there was no guarantee actually that we'd make it. I think sometime this morning we said, well, maybe we should just can this as there were sullen silences shared between the two of us. But I want to begin by just keeping it real. I just want to begin by talking, just to give a prologue to this about how we came to be an intrafaith couple.
Yeah, so for those who were present for our presentation at Sunstone last year, we talked a little bit about that. And I suppose that while we married in the temple, Gina has never been fully correlated, it'd be fair to say. and those of you who know her will respect that. But I guess her differentiation has grown over time, and there have been pivotal moments in our relationship which struck me as wake-up calls, I guess, or recognition points that the dream I had was becoming a good deal blurrier than it once was. And so things like not wanting to have a temple recommend, in this case throwing it at the bishop, not wanting to wear temple garments, choosing to take a sabbatical from church, things like that create points of crisis, certainly, for me as a true believing Mormon. And so when we were on the way here, actually, Gina said to me, can you think of a particular point at which you realised, it was gone in the way that I imagined it was going to be? And there's not one point that I would say that occurred. It kind of dawned on me over time, and for a long time, I sought to resist that. Of course, I came to the realization that resistance was futile, and I needed to find a way of engaging with Gina and accepting her new reality, which became my new reality as well, without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So I've had to deal with feelings of betrayal and loss and grief and reimagining our future together and what that means. Not just for us, of course, but we also have children. So, does that sum it up?
I don't know.
Yeah. Is there something that you think? Yeah, all right.
And from my perspective, when I started investigating the church a little bit deeper, I'd always had questions that had sat on the periphery on the shelf, and I thought, well, I think it's time for me to crack some books open. And every time I went to Nathan to say, hey, look what I just found out, he'd say, there'd be sort of blank stares, like, I don't want to know this, or, oh, that's very interesting, but it didn't shift the dial like it was shifting for me. So there was sort of incredulity and frustration that what was happening for me wasn't happening for him, because we'd always shared this life together, what I thought I had imagined had been like a spiritual sympathy with each other. Particularly when it comes to the church, we'd been called together as young men's and young women's presidents, and we'd, you know, served really well together, and I thought our religious journey was we'd clicked in with each other. So it became an enormous surprise to me that when I began to differentiate, it didn't occur to him that he ought to come with me. So that's the terrain that we're dealing with. Yeah,
I guess the reason that I didn't feel that I should go with Gina is because we were together on this train, right? We had all got a ticket on that train, and Gina had gotten offered a stop halfway to the destination, and I didn't see why I should be getting off with her, because she'd changed, not me. But of course she, you know, felt that I should have recognised why she changed, and that should affect me in the same way, but up to this point it hasn't.
Yeah. A lot of people say Nathan's not TBM. He is. Okay. Okay, so our objective with this presentation is to provide a framework for engaging the conflict, because what's happened between us has been a conflict. And as I said in the abstract, it's been a conflict that's been ongoing. We get to various points in our relationship and it's filled with sullenness and questions about the future of our marriage. And they might be seemingly benign, but they have caused ruptures, and they'll be different for different people. So it is a conflict. And how do you engage it? You can't run from it. You've got to do something with it. And it's also to discuss intra-faith marriage as a social process. Now, both of us are social scientists, so we're going to be somewhat theorising it and producing like a pattern that maybe will be useful to help for people to understand. So it's not therapy, and it's not a confessional either. I know that you might want to come to listen to our dirty secrets, but they will remain dirty secrets, won't they?
Apparently, yes.
Yes. Okay, so what is an intra-faith marriage? A marriage within the same tradition. We're used to talking about inter-faith marriage, Jews and Christians, or Muslims and Christians, or whatever it is. So this is a marriage within the same tradition where there are different levels of observance and where there has been some differentiation. Now, whether or not you choose, one of the partners chooses to differentiate their way completely out of the marriage, they still, unfortunately or fortunately, remain Mormon. So that's a different level of observance. It's a marriage where each partner's identity is being formed by different moral orders, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And this often gives way to a moral conflict, which is what Nathan and I have been dealing with. We had been occupying, unbeknownst to us, from different moral positions and in a different moral order, and expecting the other one to understand, and it's almost an impossibility. Moral conflicts, are at the heart of interfaith marriage difficulties. We think they're about beliefs, and we tease out those beliefs. Do you believe Joseph Smith was a prophet? Do you believe he translated the Book of Mormon? And then we argue about, you know, the toss about whether or not that's the case. But in actual fact, it's much heavier and bigger and wider than that. What we're talking about is us coming out of a different moral world, a different moral order. And what usually happens is that there's a lot of fear and insecurity and this lack of trust result. And so, as I said before, arguments are really symptomatic of the difference that we have in moral orders. Do you want to say?
Yeah. I think because the church gives us a set of morals, right? So mine are all very clearly in place. Gina remembers what they were because she was in that space. And then as you differentiate, you need to set up your own set of morals based on another framework. And I guess that negotiating that can cause points of conflict.
So the foundation, and as Nathan says, like, there's this way of understanding the world often supplied. Now, we're going to get into social theory, I apologise. Throw up your hand if I'm losing you, if you're not, if you're a mathematician or something. So So there are ways that of understanding the world that gets made and shaped in groups. So we inherit that, a way of understanding, a whole world vision, a lens on the world. And we share that identity in our social groups. We can go into church on a Sunday and know for sure that there's going to be at least a dozen people who are going to share a worldview, because that was constituted, that's reproduced in a group, and provided to us by the organisation of Mormons as a social group. And so there's this shared identity and this worldview / moral order. And when we talk about morality, it's not necessarily that we believe that sex before marriage is wrong. We're using the larger understanding or definition of moral order. This is a way of making sense of the world that sits deeply with us as making sense. And so we have that, and we have that shared moral order, and that's a really important foundation in most Mormon marriages. It's also part of our social contract when we go into church. We are there to reinforce or to support the tribe's understanding of their moral order. Like, we wouldn't think to raise a hand and say, well, actually, I think a good romp on the hay is a really good idea to determine whether or not you want to be married to this person. We don't do that because we are subscribing to the rules of that particular moral order, which is to support no sex before marriage. And so these mindsets and these assumptions we share as a group, and they're shaped by the group, and they carry over into marriage. So there's a whole lot of stuff that I never had to ask Nathan about when we first got married. Unlike other couples who come from different worldviews, they kind of put things together gradually and slowly, and I'm not saying that that's all good, but there were some assumptions that I could make about him and some assumptions he could make about me, and we had those sorted because we were Mormon.
We thought we did.
Yeah, we thought we did. You know, as it turns out, and we were talking about this before, as it turns out, I think some of the assumptions that he made about me based on, you know, maybe me sharing my testimony were probably a little bit misguided. So when I was saying God, I have a testimony of God and the power of numinous power, or, you know, God being in unity with the, you know, the wind and the trees. He was thinking, ah, that's the God that appeared.
She never said that before I married.
I felt that,
you.
But I felt that.
She says it a lot now.
But I felt that. Yes, yes. So this sort of trust and certainty that we have in our marriage is a contingent upon our attachment to that moral order, and that's provided by the group. So it goes, group shapes the order, we get inscribed with the mindset and the assumptions, and we get attached to it. So, and so all of these Mormon social agreements occur, social agreements, or this moral order is made up of laws. These are commandments, etc., things that we agree to, a behavioral, to manage our behavior, questions of morality, questions of ritual. And usually, if you look at the Jewish, the way that Jewish interfaith marriages operate, they have to negotiate those three things: law, morality, and ritual. This is if you've got an Orthodox or a Reformed Jew putting together a life. I added two categories to that, which was eschatological imagination. In other words, what do we see the end times as? How are we a forever family? Is this going to go on for eternity? And what are we doing about preparing for that eternity? So we make agreements. When we got sealed in the temple, we made an agreement that we would be together forever. And we also have these other social agreements, and that is that the role of the church is almost a third party in our relationships. And because it's an organizing cultural system, it kind of keeps the wheels of the system going. Can you say anything?
Yeah, no, I'm just really pleased that you admitted that we did have an agreement we would be together forever. Still basking in that, really.
Yeah,
it absolutely is. And I think one of the things that point this list here points to, and we'll go into it in more detail, but just how encompassing being a member of the church is, right? It is absolutely a way of life. And so when that contract, which is to some extent unspoken and unwritten, is just accepted, right? When that contract is broken, there's a lot of fear associated with that. where's this going to go to? What does it mean for us? And we're going to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that we have is the question of an eternal family. I'm not sure about this eternity thing, but he is absolutely sure about the eternity thing. And so that, I mean, you know, imagine that you have one partner in the relationship who's actually committed to this for eternity, and another partner in the relationship who's committed to it until we die, and who knows?
Or maybe less sometimes, as you suggested.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Disruption to this whole world, this whole moral order. And we're talking about differentiation partway through the marriage, which causes an intrafaith, reconstitution of marriage as an intrafaith marriage. Changes to the agreement, etc., puts a lot of our shared stories and narratives in jeopardy. So he might say, this testimony resonated with me this way, and I'm thinking that testimony needs to be flushed down the toilet, should never be uttered again ever in a sacrament meeting. So we don't share, you know, a lot of those kind of ecstasies we no longer share. A lot of the charisms we no longer share. Ways of praying we no longer resonate with. And to make room for that change is really difficult, particularly when it began as an agreement. When there's a disruption, I become the source of that disruption. I become the fault for that disruption. And that puts in jeopardy the role, our roles and rules and responsibilities that we have used to shape and put boundaries around our marriage.
Agreed, yeah. You're the fault for the disruption. But I guess one of the things that the true believing spouse, from my perspective, needs to remember, and this is something, a place that I needed to get to, was that it wasn't necessarily a choice that Gina made. It kind of like falling in love, it was something that happened to her and she responded to, and you know, maybe people in the room who can understand that. Just because I haven't been in that space doesn't mean I shouldn't respect the fact that for her it wasn't, I'm going to choose to differentiate now, had enough of that, I'm going to do this thing over here, and it doesn't matter how you feel about that. It wasn't like that. It was something that happened to her and she needed to respond to. So I think that's important to note.
Yeah. I think we got to that point with you being able to say that, like this morning. I'm kidding. Okay, I think. So what are the pressing issues that come after this disruption? There's a whole lot of questions that we have to ask of each other. Do I really want to stay married to someone who doesn't share my worldview? Here's his, here's mine. And in the initial stages, it looks like we are worlds apart. Can I still love my husband or wife when they are so attached to the thing that I no longer respect? That's the hardest one. Can I see you separate from and deserving of my love, even if you love something that right now I feel like I hate? Can I love you when you've become what I've been taught to fear? Is there any hope when there are incommensurate worldviews and different social realities? It looks very bleak, doesn't it? Can I forgive you for changing? And can I forgive you for not changing and coming with me? And something we talked about with Terry this morning was good faith agreement. Do we fall back into a good faith agreement? And those of you who are lawyers, I am not, will understand a good faith agreement is, here's the contract, and if anything happens, we will just treat that in good faith and make any adjustments as necessary. Did I get that right, Terry? Yeah, okay. And I don't think we understand in Mormonism that we do have, that the agreements that we make at marriage are actually good faith agreements. We think actually that's it for the rest of our lives. We don't build into it a good faith agreement because most of how we have viewed the world has been quite certain and quite complete.
Mm. Well, union conveners also understand good faith agreements because in the union, of course, you have these
union
agreements.
Yeah.
Union.
Yeah.
You have those agreements with an organisation all the time. But one of the things, I guess, in terms of what makes it a good faith agreement in practice is that when you interpret what your spouse is saying, you have to interpret it giving them the benefit of the doubt. So when Gina says to me, I don't want to go to church today or anymore, I don't interpret that as that's her way of sticking a knife into me. that's not the reason she's doing it. She's doing it because she doesn't feel comfortable at church for any number of reasons. And so honouring a good faith agreement means that you see your spouse as innocent until proven guilty, I guess. That their intent isn't to hurt or to harm either their spouse or the relationship, but it's actually to be true to themselves.
So I want to talk. We want to talk a little bit now about actually what's causing this necessity for us to talk about intrafaith marriages. And so it's helpful to look at the church as a system and how it's going. And this is somewhat, you know, this comes from an uncorrelated Mormon. I still actively attend, and I have a calling. visiting teachers. But, you know, I'm very upfront about my picking and choosing. I've recused myself from any priesthood authority. I publicly wrote a letter to say, you know, no longer as priesthood holders have any right to assume any power over me. I don't want your temple recommend, and I'll just think what I like and come when I like and do it how I want to. So there. So this comes from my perspective. This is how I'm seeing the church. And I ran it by the TBM, and he sort of, you know, gave a sullen yes. Okay, so what we have in the Elders Church is a high-demand orthodoxy and orthopraxy. So it's a high-demand belief system and it's a high-demand practice system. It's very it's obviously patriarchal. It's complementary, which is women have their roles and men have their roles. It has a centralised authoritarian ecclesia. It's simultaneously theologically innovative and correlated, so it's kind of confused, basically. It's theologically deeply confused. So I can say, wow, Joseph Smith said this about woman and priesthood, and Nathan says, but the correlated curriculum says this. And so, you know, they're creating arguments between us. So it's also corporatized and it's centrally controlled. It's like a franchise. Most people who've been bishops know, or priesthood leaders know, that their job is to replicate the system according to the architecture given to you in the handbook. You don't get the opportunity to move outside of that. It's politically conservative. Thank you, Utah. It's a gerontocracy. It's an oligarchy. There is no clearinghouse to deal with matters of law, theological matters of law or morality or ritual. There's no investment in theological training or pastoral training. As a result, I think it has, of it being a high demand religion, it has low retention, but it is cradle to grave, so you're supposed to be in it for eternity. It probably stages, this is my Baptist pastor, I cheat on Mormonism with the Baptist church. My pastor worked with James Fowler, who does Stages of Faith, and in a conversation with him, he would stage it as a 2-3 church, which is, it's a conventional faith, and most of our faith life comes through reflecting off other people, rather than going deeply into an inner life, which is breathing winds of the Spirit into us in an innovative way. I don't believe it was that way at the beginning, but it certainly is now. But it is supportive and embraces and holds intimate social relationships, but it also has this very tight moral order that often isn't questioned by the group. So that creates... Do you want to add anything?
No, I think it sums it up.
Okay. And so that creates an interesting issue because all, you know, history is about confronting or... coming up against new moral contexts or new contexts that need moral that produce moral questions that need answers. Okay, so for instance, in our contemporary moment, we need to ask questions about economy. Like, how do you do a political economy? Is it right to divide, distribute through taxation money for the poor? What do we do about this increasing pressure for same-sex marriage? What do we do about race issues, etc.? So all of these new social contexts require the ecclesia or the church leaders to produce answers that reflect the values and morals of the group. That's their job. And these new answers surprisingly create new goals or shifts in values. It sort of moves the group. We don't feel it so much, but think about the effect the question over same-sex marriage has had in Mormonism. And the way in which the social group kind of ruptured and convulsed and moved around this and created new objectives to eject or to reject people, LGBTQ people. Do you want to say anything about that?
Latter-day Saints in some contexts are forced to make decisions in relation to that, right? I mean, the whole Prop 8 program or campaign in California is a fine example, right? So it wasn't benign. Members were put in a position where they had to decide which side they were on, when they could have, perhaps previously, in terms of a relationship, that didn't need to be a talking point necessarily, but it forced it to the front.
Yeah, so because the church provided an answer, which is let's combat this politically and let's recruit the masses to do this. This wasn't an adequate answer for a lot of people, and that's what happens when social groups start to change, where people say, hold on, that is not an answer that sits well with me. And that causes massive disruptions in terms of our attachment to the social group, and people find themselves spiralling out. And when you start spiralling out on one issue, you realise actually that was just one issue in which a whole moral world was encompassed, and you begin to ask questions. And so it's not unusual to hear people reevaluate, like spend months and weeks on the internet listening to podcasts and reading everything they possibly can to try and reevaluate their moral world and to kind of create a new moral order. And a lot of this is because, you know, sometimes the leadership is unwilling to update or adequately address these new moral questions, and that causes major problems. And so when something upsets me, that doesn't upset him, that creates, and we therefore have now incompatible values and objectives in our lives, and a whole new moral universe opens up to me that he doesn't share. Does that make sense? Is there any question? Any questions? Okay. And a lot of these, this change, this disruption to the moral order or our world views has come about because of digital Mormon citizenship. It used to be that you'll be sitting in church and you think, I don't really agree with that. And then you just sort of leave it. But now you can go online after church or during church and say, I don't believe this. And other people go, I don't believe it either. And all of a sudden you've just created a new social group who choose not to agree with something. And you feel, because we're such herd animals, we feel emboldened and supported in that position. The openness of information, of course, that's been done to death. A familial or personal disruption, perhaps our child chooses to leave the church, or perhaps our child was LGBTQ, that causes a massive issue in terms of our attachment to our child and then our attachment to the church. There's a disruption. Also, education and critique. We learn things, we trip over things, we're actively involved, we learned how to critique systems. And I want to say here, sometimes it's just faith development. Sometimes the answers provided by the organisation, by the church, aren't adequate for where we are in terms of our faith development. And I like to put in company with my pastor, I like to say optimistically that sometimes God is actually calling us into speaking to us from a different place in the room. Because maybe, just maybe, this is going to be a saving grace for a church that is sort of burying itself in orthodoxy.
Yeah, and in terms of our relationship, that's certainly an understanding that I had to come to. You know, for a long time, as Gina was differentiating, I was praying that Gina would find God more fully. And for me that meant, you know, more fully engaging with the church again, accepting it all, you know, sustaining the brethren, etc. It wasn't until one day she said to me, she said, I just want you to let me go so that I can find God where I am. And I realized then that that was the answer to my prayer, and that's what I needed to do. But the way I had framed what I thought the answer would look like was obfuscating me being able to see that. And that was a revelation to me, and an important one in terms of letting Gina do that.
I would have done it anyway, but it's just nice that you have. Let me.
That's true. Yeah. You don't need my permission to do anything, really.
Yeah, that's true. These conditions create this powder keg moment. I think all of us have responded in some way to this powder keg moment. And what we now have is a moral conflict. Oh my goodness, how did that get to be Greek? Does anyone know how to read this? I actually am at divinity school, and they gave me the Greek lesson, and I could possibly read it phonetically, but basically, a moral conflict is a massive disruption in terms of our worldviews. Okay, did I get it right? So that is that.
It's not.
It's just transliterated. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know how that happened.
Thanks, Jane.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, so when we called this engaging the conflict, this is what we're talking about: engaging the moral conflict. And moral conflict is often considered a communication problem. And if we kind of shift it to that, as in not a belief problem, but a communication problem. And it usually, underlying all of that conflict is a sense of fear. So I'm responding, I don't know what my marriage is to my husband if I'm an uncorrelated Mormon or a progressive, I don't know what, a reformed Mormon, and he's an Orthodox Mormon, he doesn't know how to be in relationship with someone who's a reformed Mormon, and he's been taught that everything that I'm now cool with is wrong. So how do we put that together in this? And because our communication is so poor about this, and because our communication is largely about what do you believe, and we're wrestling with belief systems, we're misunderstanding the potentiality and calling it a communication issue. So misunderstandings are rife in these situations, because now one comes from one moral world, one has another moral world, and we're trying to talk to each other across using different signifiers and languages that seem to prove to the other person that we're as difficult or hopeless as we had imagined. So I might, in my moral world, I might say to Nathan, I think moderation in alcohol is great. Like, as long as there are no issues with addiction, etc. A little bit here and a little bit there, what does it matter? It's a social thing and it's tasty. And for me, that fits my moral world. But for him, he's not hearing that. I could come up with all of the literature in the world to try and convince him that a wine with a meal is actually okay. I don't have wine with my meals, by the way.
I know.
Yeah, not around doing that. And I could come up with all the literature and the reasons and the arguments why. But he's not going to hear that, because I am doing that arguing from my own moral order. And I'm not speaking to his moral order, which is actually no alcohol ever. And God hates you if you do.
And a good analogy, it's probably overstating the case, but that's not unusual. A good analogy for those of you who've served missions, when you serve a mission in a prominently Christian country, right, you can use the Bible as a point of reference to discuss potential changes in people's lives that lead to baptism in the LDS Church. But if you're serving a mission in India or in China or Taiwan or somewhere, a Buddhist country, for example, the Bible's of little value, because who is Jesus Christ, right? And you can't use that as a basis from which to discuss these things. So you have to find a basis which is further, I guess, back up the chain. And it's the same in relation to marriages with this differentiation. You've got to find a point at which you can agree in order to find some common ground.
Mm, yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. So we've got mistrust and suspicion. I'm seeing the other person doing things that I've never seen them before, and I'm trying to suspect that and mistrust it. And hostility, negative stereotyping, and we get this at church, and this isn't just in marriage relationships, it's other family relationships. I understand you as an apostate. I understand that you are faithless, that you haven't endured to the end, and you need to read your scriptures and say prayers. And also this non-negotiability, all of this hostility, just kind of like ossifies our hearts, and we just start firing at each other from our rigid definitions of the world.
And just to add, that goes both ways, because Jean's kind of, I think, probably presented that in the way that this is what the true believer sees of the reformer or the transitioner. But also, that it goes the other way, because there are discourses that the transitioning member already has in their head. So they think that you, as the believing spouse, is going to see them in that way. If they do that, you want to talk about the alcohol, and you have a drink of alcohol,
I immediately think she's apostate. Well, that's not necessarily the case. I may not see it that way, but it may be interpreted that that's the way I would see it, because they remember seeing it that way when they were once a believer. So sometimes there are ghosts from, I would say there are ghosts from the transitioning member's past which get reflected back also on the believing spouse.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's really important to consider that underneath all of this is fear, because everything is so tremulous and disruptive and sort of volatile. People's feet aren't steady on the ground, and so obviously that causes a lot of fear. Now, there are a lot of harms that happens as a result, as some of us know. It causes couples to behave, and even families to behave immorally. And I've heard a lot of family members who have differentiated be attacked by other family members in ways that are appalling. That, you know, maybe they're a bishop, or maybe that, you know, they, in every other circumstance you've only seen them behave in a morally respectable way, and then to attack somebody who is differentiated and reject them. And these are morally, you know, reprehensible behaviours and alienating behaviours. On the other hand, it might cause people to the differentiating spouse to what is called throw off the traces and just go wild, because, you know, you can't with the idea, I can't please everybody. I can't please my husband. I can't please my family. So I'm just gonna, well, here you go. Here's the whole kit and caboodle. I'm just gonna just go crazy. The other tendency of the harm it is we stop seeing each other and we start dehumanising each other. You know, I'm an apostate, you're just a robot of the organisation. And Little John and Barrett Pierce say difficulty in describing the substantive issues in shared terms, that is at the heart of the disruption, because we're arguing from different moral positions and we disagree about the meaning and significance of those important issues. Okay, so the challenges are now that we are arguing across moral orders. We don't inhabit the same worldview. And the other thing is that, as I said before, we choose beliefs to debate and they make for very poor quality discussions. Has anybody had a discussion about a belief with somebody and it's like resulted in very little change in anybody? It just angers people. And so when... And the other thing is that we need to see the moral world that belief is constituted in. So when we have an argument about the word of wisdom, perhaps, or Joseph Smith, let's talk about Joseph Smith, for instance. We have an argument about maybe Joseph Smith being a con man. I can say to Nathan, look, I believe Joseph Smith was a complete con man. I'm not sure that I believe that, so just don't take that as read. And I might argue with him from the point of research or... etc. And I would think, I would expect him to look at that research and say, oh yes, he is a con man, because this is very conclusive proof that he was. But what I'm not understanding is that the idea of Joseph Smith being a prophet of the restoration sits as just one chink in this whole, as one domain in this whole world that he's created. And if I start moving that piece, that one belief, it moves his moral world, and everything else starts having to shift as well, and you might just not be ready to have everything shifted. So that's what people are holding on to, not necessarily the individual beliefs, which there may be some concessions in, but I don't want to enter into that space. I don't want to make that belief your argument, my argument, because that may begin to change everything else about my moral universe.
And, you know, I mean, I like to think that while we've been able to have those discussions, they have often led to angry conflict. Gina earlier talked about sullenness. So that seems to be the response from one of us. The response from the other one tends to be anger, swearing, and I'm not going to mention who is kind of in either of those camps, but so, you know, one way that it's dealt with is withdrawal and silence, and another way it's dealt with is anger and a lot of sometimes, you know, offensive attacks. So I guess what Gina's saying is if we want to resolve the real issue in differentiated faith in a relationship. Using beliefs as the point of trying to do that are probably less effective than some of the other things that we'll talk about.
Yeah, as is persuasion and coercion. You can't persuade people, you can't coerce them. It doesn't resolve the conflict. And so, as we said before, this moral conflict might be better served by calling it a communication problem. And so there's the communication choices that arise. Okay, so if it's a communication problem, how do we manage this? Often there's a choice between two positions. One is repression and one is engagement. And repression, I want to say, is repression actually going silent on the issues. I am not going to talk about this issue. This is becoming a no-go zone. Is actually, you know, deeply harmful psychologically. Logically and in terms of the relationship. So really, if you want to wade through, if you want to resolve this this moral conflict, engagement is probably the only choice. Now, warmongering or peacemaking, what do we choose? Now, I prefer the idea of shalom and as a broader idea about this dynamic, energetic harmony that we want to have with each other, rather than actually we're just going to be really peaceful and say nothing and play classical music and and watch G-rated movies together. That's not what we're talking about. And or encapsulation or transcendence. This is actually we're going to ring fence the set of issues that we have, or we're actually going to transcend them and find something else. We're going to keep coming back to the ring to fight these arguments, or we're going to go into something else, another space, which is what we'll talk about now. Oh, sorry, do you want to say anything about that?
Just building on what I said before about the conflict. Obviously, the more it takes its toll, right? The more conflict you enter into, where there are attacks, and at first you might attack the belief, but inevitably that leads to ad hominem, and then you start attacking the person, and that can have real consequences in terms of the health of your relationship. So. Finding a peaceful way of dealing with these differences is really where we need to get to.
Yeah, and that's why we go to transcendence. Because, once again, we're inhabiting different moral orders, different moral universes, and trying to take all of our differences and deal with our differences is often a fool's game. But transcending those differences and finding another space in which we can actually have a moral world that makes sense to us seems much more productive. And so Little John and Pierce talk about transcendent eloquence. So eloquence is the highest form of speaking. And we love eloquence, and we can think of general authorities who are deeply, wonderfully eloquent. But that only makes sense in a particular moral universe. So Nathan could say, wow, Elder Oakes was so very, very eloquent about mercy and justice today. And that makes sense to him. It won't make sense to me. So transcendent eloquence is speaking in the best possible ways, the most beautiful ways, that transcends the differences. So what is there outside of the differences? I mean, is there any hope outside of the differences? And this transcendent eloquence requires that we just deconstructing, thinking about the moment objectively. What's happening here? What's the framework in which I need to think about? And I don't think that we have been armed very well with good structures and frameworks and ideas to help us deal with the conflicts that we're having in intrafaith marriage, but also intrafaith families. Thinking about rather than reacting to, asking the question, okay, take a breath, what's happening here? What patterns are emerging here? Exploring rather than trying to convince. Okay, so you insist on wearing a white shirt to church. Why? And then why? And why? Without judgment, to understand what's at the heart of that. Because a lot of our decisions that we make actually sit in the heart. They mean something to us. And so I need to understand what it means to Nathan to wear a white shirt to church. And respect that, because I can respect his heart.
And when asking those why questions, tone is very important. So it can mean quite a different thing when you say, why? As opposed to, why do you do that? Can you tell me a bit about that? Right. So the way we couch those questions can make a big difference to the constructiveness of the conversation.
This is true. Okay, so we explore rather than try and convince. We assess the strengths and weaknesses of both worldviews, and this comes with a caveat, that I don't assess the weakness of his worldview, and he doesn't assess the weakness of my worldview, but that I assess the weakness of my own worldview, and he is up for assessing the weakness of his own worldview, and that I assess the strengths of his worldview, and he assesses the strengths of mine. Because I can talk to my own strengths easily, as can you. But assessing each other's, what we see each other's strengths to be, it's a practice. It's actually a deeply profound spiritual practice to do that. And we can see why we don't assess the weakness of each other's frameworks, worldviews, right? Okay, and that helps us to reframe the conflict as actually something rather than circumscribed by irreconcilable and incommensurate differences to something that actually can be really creative. We also need to provide each other with security, because I think we talked about the fear that underlines all of this, and he's going to have different security needs than I am, and to hear the fear that's in him and to provide whatever security I can for that, and the other way around. And you know, this, one of the big questions is, we come back to one of the questions that we asked first was, do you still want to be married to me now that I'm different from you? Can you give me that security that while we're going through this, you're not going to bounce on our marriage? That actually we've got, you know, we're going to take some steps together to try and put together something else.
Mm. Yeah, so when you're dealing with this, it's not helpful to say, I think you should be married to someone else, as a way of softening the fact that you want to get out of the relationship, for example. And I do think that's really important, actually reassuring your spouse that you love them, whether the believing spouse or the non-believing spouse, that actually you do really love them, and because you love them, you're willing to try and understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, and even if you don't necessarily like them at that moment, you might say, you know, do I love this marriage? Or do I see hope for this marriage? Because sometimes feeling love in this moment of conflict is really difficult. But is the marriage worth it? Mm. Is this worth kind of, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and like, you know, for those who came last year, I talked about the fact that I had like this list of, for me, I had this list of non-negotiables, you know, that... If Gina started kicking things to the curb, that'll be like, well, that's a deal breaker for me, and it's a deal breaker. And I had, you know, it was like basically like a list of temple recommend questions in my head. And of course, once she started kicking things to the curb, I was in. It wasn't theoretical anymore. It wasn't hypothetical. I had to go, okay, do I really believe in this list that I've got in my head or not? And I discovered that I didn't. And, you know, my list of non-negotiables now is very small. And who knows if maybe that won't change in the future too. I don't know. But I think we really have to assess just how committed we are to our relationship over this list that we may have, that may exist in our head. I think that's more a TBM thing, probably. But it could happen the other way too, where you go, well, you know, if you're not, to a believing spouse, a less believing spouse might say, well, you know, if you're not willing to change those things, I can't live with you anymore, because how can you possibly believe that that's a non-negotiable for me? So it could go both ways. Yeah.
And some of the questions that gets us to a state of transcendent eloquence could be, does my worldview and my level of observance either side of the battlefield increase my affection for my spouse? So does my position that this, you know, maybe the church is a wonderful container for spiritual practice, but not necessarily true, does that increase my affection for my spouse? All of these questions need to be going through. Good. And how much flexibility do I have, even in my position? How much grace can I give his position? And how much grace can he give mine? But sometimes it's more hard to go back to the scene of the crime and to ascribe it some grace or goodness, and to be compassionate about it. Can we make space? Is there any room to make space for each other's worldviews? What do we agree on that we can celebrate? And in order to make, but I want to put a caveat on this, in order to make this really work, the Orthodox spouse must differentiate from the totality of the Mormon worldview. Like, it is not possible for him to continue, I have created a disruption, and the more he beds down in orthodoxy, the more difficult it's going to be. So there needs to be some give on that person's part. And the Reformed Mormon needs to respect and offer grace to aspects of that orthodox tradition in order to make the relationship work.
So it means moving from the poles, right? You've got to both move towards a point in which there's some compromise or acceptance. This is not, you know, creation science, right? Some point of recognition and acceptance for one another's views, rather than holding on to the extreme views that you might otherwise, had you not got that magnetism that you've agreed to that pull you towards that.
Yeah, I think just more than just acceptance, but actually respect for and kind of a love for.
Doesn't necessarily mean to believe it,
no.
but at least accept and respect that difference. Yeah.
And so there are a lot of questions. I'm going to go through this really quickly because we need to wrap this up. But there are a lot of questions that need to be asked now. Where do we stand with respect to Mormon laws? And, for instance, where do we stand with respect to the word of wisdom, tithing and temple recompense, chastity and Sabbath? And all of these are negotiations that we have, but do I respect the word of wisdom? Yes, I do. All right, okay, do you respect that? You know, maybe I won't drink coffee or alcohol or smoke, but, you know, can we celebrate that and not create a deficit around my odd cup of tea? So that's something to celebrate. Hey, I'm not a drunkard.
That really is something to celebrate, believe me.
And, you know, with questions of tithing, you know, so we go from gross on everything to, hey, there are now questions that we need to ask. You know, isn't it cool that we get to pay on 10% on our increase now? Yeah, great, we're paying tithing. That one's in. That
definitional discussion still underway on that.
But there may be lots of things to celebrate. I mean, maybe chastity. Okay, do we agree that we're monogamous? You know, or do we need to have questions about polyamory? We're Mormons, by the way. You know, so. etc. Now, what about Sabbath observance? And, you know, right now our agreement is that I do morning church. If I go with him to the LDS church in the mornings, he'll come with me to an evening Baptist service. Yeah, and we enjoy that, don't we?
Well, I think I've got to end that deal because obviously I get her for 3 hours and she gets me for just like an hour.
Yeah, but I really like it because he like raises his hands to sing. There's a name for that. I'm like, dude, he's like getting into this. Where do we stand with respect to Mormon morality? And morality is really about the big kind of political, social political issues. Where do we stand with respect to inclusion and race and war and economics and gender? And there are always something to celebrate, even though, you know, like for instance, when it comes to gender, Nathan is really happy about women getting the priesthood. You know, I might say, but you didn't come to Temple Square and, like, you know, stand there and demand entrance. But
someone, you know, had to look after the children.
This is true. Yeah, so I can celebrate that. And we agree on a lot of these issues about race and inclusion and war and economics. So this is a really good spot for us. This is something that we can really celebrate. What about ritual? This is probably one of the more difficult things.
Potentially.
Yeah. You know, the temple thing is the most difficult.
You know, yeah, I mean, Gina and I sat outside the Draper Temple the other night and we kind of talked through kind of where we're at with the temple and shared how we feel about it. And that is hard for me because my memories of being with Gina in the temple are treasured memories for me. And to not have any idea whether that will happen again, it's a loss for me, right? So I do grieve that. But I also respect the reasons that Gina is choosing not to do that, at least right now. And so it's not a point of conflict. It is something that we've been able to talk about and share our feelings about quite tenderly. Without it becoming a point of argument or conflict.
And where do we stand with respect to Mormon eschatology? And, you know, what are the afterlife stories that we tell? We sort of can't now, can we? Like, are we a forever family?
Well, you know, in some ways I see this as a little bit advantageous in the relationship space because we've been sealed, I kind of feel like I've got it forever. So she can differentiate as much as she wants, but she can't really escape me. So
I guess that's it then. Yeah.
That's my happy place.
And then when I say reincarnation, well, what about reincarnation? There's sort of like a blank wall. I'm like, okay, whatever. And what about ecclesiology? This is the hardest one for us.
Right, yeah. So this is where, obviously, there's a decent list up there, and probably everyone in the room can see why there might be issues. I mean, there have been... I have supported Gina in confrontations that she's had with leaders, and up until now, I don't think there's ever been a time when I haven't taken your side in relation to that. One thing that I've said to Gina is if ever... she was put in the position to encounter church discipline, which you know, it hasn't happened in our marriage.
It has been discussed, though, hasn't it, with the state president?
It concerns us how much the state president talks about it. It's kind of like... how much he says, no, we're not talking about discipline, but it's like he's reassuring himself. But as long as he keeps saying that, I'm all good. But I have said to Gina that potentially if that happened, that could be, for me, a really difficult... put me in a very, very difficult position. And I think it would very much depend on the circumstances of the case. But I'm hoping that never happens.
That's something also that I can celebrate, that if I do get disciplined, it might make you differentiate.
Yeah, I don't think you should push for it to happen, though.
I mean, a lot of this has to do with time, like how much time do we give the church? So when you differentiate, you think, okay, well, you know, it's very well to do 3 hours of church, but then what about all these meetings and these rescue visits and these, you know, ward, you know, what do you call ward councils, and, you know, and then trips to the temple, and then young men's, there's a point at which we have to negotiate, actually, what's going to be okay for our family, with me included, not as the shepherder of humans across town and to various activities. Which nobody comes home from and says, wow, that was such a great activity, I feel closer to God. Except you. Anyway. Okay, sorry. Shh. Okay. So we go into this final bit. And I'm sorry there to kind of cut it short there, because I've sort of horribilized it all, but I hope we've provided a framework for us to understand it. But I think one of the things that this conflict provides is like this dynamic energy, spiritual energy, to create something beautiful. Something that doesn't have the hallmarks of institution on it so much as it has our fingerprints and our hearts all in it. And this calls us to find a Tao, which is the still point between opposites, this quiet place. We can kind of scream at each other as much as we can about our differences, but at some point, I think the universe offers a grace, a quiet place. So what's coming up in that quiet place? And invariably you find love and compassion. And the kind of compassion that doesn't need to be intellectually dealt with or dealt with through beliefs, but it's just pure compassion. And is there a new worldview that we, a view sitting in our ground of being that we can both inhabit? Is there something for us that we can find space for? I look at it optimistically. Often differentiation creates wonderful opportunities for spiritual creativity and for God to speak it to us in different ways. And so the question we need to ask ourselves, well, what fresh winds of the Spirit are blowing through our relationship? It would be really nice if Mormons were constituted or socially constructed to actually look really optimistically and as a blessing when somebody differentiates. So I don't always feel the rebel, but actually, you know, I'm somebody, and you know, and some people here have differentiated and looked at as like, wow, how's God speaking to you now? How's the universe speaking to you now? Tell us about that. What kind of moral questions and answers is God speaking into your life? I sound like an evangelical, don't I? Is there a union, a theology of union? And I think there is. You just have to open the New Testament. Look at Ephesians about this theology of union, that what's important is not sameness, but putting different parts of ourselves get it, sounds like sex, but it kind of is, different parts of ourselves together, to create a whole. And also, let's look at contextual theology. Contextual theology asks, how is God speaking to us both in our different spaces? And we use this with different cultures we go in. And there's this wonderful story of an evangelical that was seeded or planted in Kenya, and the missionaries had a question about whether or not they should extract themselves and allow for the local Kenyans to run the church. So what they do in the evangelical tradition now, and I say evangelical in the liberal sense as in New Zealand, not the American sense, so don't, a Protestant tradition, is they employ anthropologists to come in and kind of do a big audit of the situation. So they put the Kenyans in one room and they put the Americans in another room and said, here's a text. Joseph's in Egypt. Tell us what you think the moral of the story is. So the Americans came out and said, we've absolutely got it. We've got it. The moral of the story is, and many of us here will respond to this positively, the moral of the story is it not that if you do what God wants you to do, you'll be blessed. Right? Is that the moral of the story that most of us have resonated with? The Kenyans came out and said, oh, it's absolutely clear. It's clear. The moral of the story is that family always comes first. Okay, now what's right? What's wrong? They're both right. Okay? And so, how is God speaking into both of our lives? All right. Okay. That is us. Sorry, that's a long, long-winded thing. Do you want to say anything?
Well, I just wanted to say that something that I've found helpful is to not weaponize where you're at or your beliefs or your kind of religious or spiritual system. That can be really destructive. So one of the things that's really helped me is that Gina has still respected and accepted things like the fact that that I hold the priesthood, and she will still ask me for priesthood blessings. And it's actually been in giving her priesthood blessings that I have come to realize how much God loves her and is with her and directing her in her journey, so I don't need to worry so much. That fear is replaced by love, and I can let her go and do what she's doing. And I've been able to do that through my own religious praxis, but it's worked because she's respected that. And I think that's one example of how you can make it work.
Thank you.
That was really great. We have 25 minutes still for questions. And so if everybody could ask their questions clearly into the mic, because this is being recorded. You guys can just line up.
Sorry, not a question. Just a real heartfelt thanks that you guys will stand up and just be so real and so raw and show that you're working to make it happen. We can tell that you're not at a happy place. I mean, I hope you're at a happy place, but there's still some real stuff there.
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much for your courage. You know, you're helping a lot of us that are struggling. So.
Thank you very much.
I also want to thank you for coming. This is really hard spot for me. I'm with Gina off the train. And you remind me so much of my husband, who I just adore. He's just a wonderful, wonderful man. And he's having such a hard time. And I see him doing a lot of the things that you're doing as well. And I'm so grateful for that. But I want to ask you, Nathan, what can I do to help him, to support him? What has Gina done for you, or what things would you like her to do to support you and your family who's still active and that sort of thing? Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. A great question. I think, you know, one of the reasons we are still together is because Gina has made a huge effort. You know, I don't know if you saw our presentation last year, but we prepared our presentations on how we had kind of worked inside the space, and I wanted to show her what I'd done before I presented it. But after I did it, I decided I didn't want to, so I told her, and she said, well, I'm not going to show you mine either. And when we got up there, it was that she, I don't know which order it was going in, but she went first, and I was absolutely blown away that for the first time I realized that she understood my pain. And so that made a big difference to me, that she wasn't oblivious to what I was experiencing. And I think maybe you experienced a bit of the same when I shared mine, that I actually saw more than perhaps I had shared. So going to your second question about what could you do, I think let him know that you understand why it's hard for him. That could make a big difference to him, that you're not just frustrated, because what I was getting from Gina a lot was, she's just frustrated with me that I don't get it, you know, like, would I just get it already, you know? And you probably relate to that, right? But that's what I was hearing. I wasn't hearing that she understood that it was painful for me, and it meant giving up a lot that I wasn't ready to give up. And knowing that she could respect that made a big difference in terms of me then trying to understand her. So that would be one thing. But there are other things, like, you know, I talked about the fact that she will still ask for priesthood blessings. That means a great deal to me. Also, because she's kind of bailed on the typical, like, Mormon scripture study, right? But she's been willing recently to introduce scripture study using the New International Version of the Bible. So now we read the Bible together as a family with about three or four different versions now. King James, New International Version, you know, a couple of others. And so she's found a space in which something which is important to me, we can still do as a family that works for her. You know, it may not be reading the Book of Mormon, but we're still studying the scriptures, which it works, you know. So just finding ways to try and meet each other in that space. Yeah, I guess that's what I'd say.
Thank you.
I love you guys both so much. My wife and I are navigating similar to you. She's TBM. I have a college daughter who's TBM, and then a son, adult son, who's gay with a partner. And so earlier this week, I wanted to broach the subject. In the U.S., temple marriage and sealing is done on the same day, right? And so there's this construct, although it's not doctrinal, that's my opinion, that they're two different things. And so I brought up to my wife, I said, you know, I said, if our daughter someday is faced with a dilemma about her father and her brother's partner and her sister-in-law not being able to be there for a sealing, I'd like to share with her that I will support her, whether it's in the temple or whether she decides that she wants to get married. And in the U.S., due to the policy, she'd have to wait a year. And that was a powder keg discussion with my wife. Because her fear is that I'm differentiated, my son is differentiated, and now I'm going to potentially push my daughter to be differentiated. So that's something that we don't know how. I said, I'm not going to go talk to her about it until we've talked about it first. So that's something we're negotiating, and I really appreciate what you've shared, because maybe that'll help me. But then the other thing that I wanted to share is that subsequent to the tears and emotionally charged discussion, I said, you know, I miss the spiritual part of our relationship, and I miss the ritual or religious practice part of our relationship, and we've overcompensated for that in the other areas, but I want that again. And my wife is an amazing woman, and she says, we can do it in places where we find God together. And she said, we can find God together in ministering to to children, to go to Guatemala with Jody, to do other things, and we can rebuild that part of our relationship. And I was so grateful that she brought that up. But in any event, how do you negotiate the powder kegs that are really difficult, right? Because my wife and I may never be able to figure out how to jointly present my feelings about our, when our daughter gets married to my daughter. But at the same time, what are other ways that we can find God in it together so we can rebuild that part of our relationship?
I think that's a really powerful question, and I really feel that. And I'm thinking about, if we could stick with your daughter's situation, both of you love your daughter, and both of you are doing what, want to share what you share because you love her. That's all that matters. And if you can trust, if either, both of you can trust the love that you have for your daughter, then you can leave your daughter to make that decision, because both of those positions will come out of a feeling of deep love. Don't make your daughter the battleground that you work out the church on. Just do, say what you need to say because you love her. Yeah, and I think this is great for kids, actually. It's wonderful for children to work out different worldviews. It, you know, it probably doesn't feel like that for your wife, where there's only one worldview, but the reality for your marriage is that you both are navigating two different worldviews, and that now adjusts, changes things for your daughter. And so she has got decisions now to make. I don't think there can be one way for... I think there is a myth that there can still be one way for the children. They're not stupid. They see what the battleground. They are very, very emotionally keyed into it. So if there are two conflicting worldviews going on, be creative about it, enjoy it, celebrate it, and trust them to make powerful decisions because you've given them options.
So it's hard. It's hard to put our daughter in a situation where she would need to choose, right? Something that is deeply meaningful to my wife, of not that a marriage outside of the temple is less than, but she has this ideal and belief and witness, and we experience that, and she wants that for our daughter. And so it's tough. I guess there's not really an answer to put your daughter in a situation where she knows she's going to disappoint one of us, but know that we, even if we're disappointed, we love her and accept her and support her, whether it's a ring ceremony or whether she waits a year or whatever, you know. So it's tough. How do you, I mean, your kids aren't old enough to deal with this yet, but they're going to navigate this soon, right? So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we do have one who's an adult. He's not really considering marriage at the moment. I think he's just, you know, putting it about. But for us, it's interesting, we don't have to worry about that, because we got married in 1992, and in New Zealand, up until 1994, temple marriages weren't recognised at law, because they had to be performed in a public place. And as you know, temples not. So we, and the irony in this is, Gina didn't want to have a big civil wedding, because she'd been married before, right? She was like, no, I don't do all that again. Didn't work out anyway. So, it was my first time. I was like, oh, well, you know, I want to have all our friends and so on. So the law worked in my favour. I totally agree with Gina. Like, it will have to be her decision. And I just think that, in my humble opinion, what you and your wife need to do is to make sure that she knows whatever she chooses, you'll support her in. And it may have a lot to do with who she marries, to be honest, and maybe even their family. So, and let's call it what it is. Like you say, not that, you know, civil marriage is less than. For most believing Mormons, they will see it as less than. Let's be real, right? Who authorizes civil marriage in this country? Donald Trump? Like... I don't mean to be rude, but there'll be a lot of people who will see that as less than, even if they vote Republican. And in terms of your second question about where you can find God together, because I don't know that we've addressed that yet. This may sound tacky, but you know what a Venn diagram is? So, yeah, exactly. So there'll be places that you have found God in your life, and there'll be places that your wife has found God in her life. And I think, you know, whether you write it down or not, or just verbalize it, I'm guessing there'll be some of those spaces in which you both found God, and I would say utilize those.
So I'm also in an interfaith marriage, although I'm the more practicing one of our marriage. When my husband wanted to stop going to church, he sat on it for a while, and only to define when he finally came out and told me that he wanted to stop going to church, that I really didn't care. He'd been like filled with all this angst and stress about this conversation, but I really appreciate that you guys are now presenting a framework for having these kind of discussions and breaking them down into their component parts in a way that will help couples understand each other better. And certainly my husband stopped going to church has been great for our marriage, because that was one of the things you talked about, what the benefits would be. And it's been great for us, so he's happier.
Yeah, I want to say something about that, Jane Anne, because against all, even my own imagination, like I think I'm happier. Like the minute I gave in my temple recommend, threw in my temple recommend. The minute I gave myself permission to play around the edges and go to different churches, and I had the sabbatical. I've been and I've come back to church, and I'm pretty regular, but I'm immensely happy. I can be much more happily on the pews than I ever was, and I can't imagine. I hadn't been able to imagine that.
Yeah. But I think the fact that he was kind of projecting what he assumed my reaction might be, and that was kind of causing a lot of pain and stress in his life. And I could see that maybe happening the way you were talking about, you know, your wife or your daughter maybe projecting something that they assume is going to happen, or assume that with the way you're going to feel about something. Mm-hmm. And the way that you're now presenting a framework for having these discussions earlier, before you have to have all that stress.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Hey guys. Okay, so my question is more about like decision making, either in a marriage or in a family. I have a specific case, but it could be broadened. So specifically with my marriage, one of us has resigned and has nothing, can't hate the church. The other one of us is me, and you know, I'm kind of something, you know. I'm figuring things out, and my husband would like to take our kids' names off the records, and I would like to keep them, and he's so sure what he wants, and I don't know, and I'm not willing to make that choice yet. And I say, well, why can't we just let them decide about baptism? But that's so far away. They're 2 and 4. So what do you do about these, like, these yes and no, these black and white questions where you really need to make a decision? And, it's good just question. That's like, we have no idea.
I can just theorize, because one of the things that is characteristic of Mormonism is its binaries, that there's a yes and a no, there's an in and there's an out, and there's a right and a wrong. I think that that one thing that we do is we take those binaries outside of the church.
Totally.
We become certain in the other direction. We trade one certainty for another. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the answer to this is. I mean, there are two of you in this, and there are a couple of kids.
Right.
But I would say, what I would ask you to consider, what is the principle that's sitting underneath your lack of certainty about it and his certainty about it? And address those first before you make any kind of yes-no decisions. Is it Sam's fear? Is it, you know, is it anger? Is anger driving it? Is that a good driver to make kind of religious decisions, or is passivity a good, you know, a desire not to get involved with the hardness of this? Is that a good decision? So I would suggest that. Now, it's the Tao. You know, what's the silent point between this? What's that telling us? What's the creative pulse that it's giving us? to go deeper into an inner life and resolve that before we take care of the flotsam and jetsam, all of the decisions. There's something powerful and potentially really beautiful in that engagement. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's great advice. And you know, I kind of feel like, going back to how you ask the why question, why do you want their names removed? Making sure the tone's all right. But I guess you can also have the discussion about what harm or damage there is in either leaving the names there or removing them. And is this a die in a ditch thing? Is this a big enough deal to really worry about? Does it matter that much if their name is on the record or not until they're old enough to make that call themselves?
Yeah.
And I, you know, I get he'd probably say, well, they didn't choose to put their name on there.
Yeah, they had no choice in it.
Yeah, it's an obvious one, right?
Right.
It's true.
But so why can't they choose when they can make a choice?
For it to be on or not.
Of course.
Yep, absolutely. But the question is, when the name went on, you were both in agreement, I assume, on mm-hmm. that. And so now there's been a change, and is this a big enough deal to fight over, or are really the consequences of it being there or not that big a deal? So let's talk about things that really matter. Like, is it even having an impact on the children, their name being there or not?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that happens is the primary presidency wants to visit.
Oh, and that could, depending on
right,
the
right, which we just say no, you know, you just, yeah.
You can say no, lots. Or you can say, yeah, we'd love a visit if that's what you'd want. And is it like, is the primary president a bad person to be visiting your children? I don't know.
Right.
No. Just whatever's underneath, I think. Just go to whatever's underneath.
Cool. Thank you.
Hey, thanks you guys for sharing. This has been great. But so my wife is an Orthodox believer, and I started a faith crisis like 4 years ago, and I went through a phase of agnosticism, atheism, and took a sabbatical from church from a year and a half, and I started going back in January, and I've largely gotten through the angsty part of my, at least I think I have, I'll probably go back into it at some point, but that's my naivete. I'm reading a lot of Christian authors like Peter Enns and Borg and John Shelby Sprong, and all these people, and I'm finding a lot of really positive things to focus on, and I feel like I'm making good contributions in Sunday school now, and I'm feeling like I'm making a positive movement forward. Yet in my interactions with my wife or some family members that are also very Orthodox, I feel like they're still mourning the loss of the old me. And maybe viewing me as, I don't know, not being authentic almost, or like it's some weird phase I'm going through and it's not real or something. And I'm having a hard time engaging with them in my new positive direction that I'm feeling, because I'm kind of passed over the mourning part of my old self, and I'm not sure that they are willing to move on to the new me. And so just any suggestions from your perspective on how to, I don't know, get them to view my new path as being more authentic and genuine, because it is genuine from my perspective.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I know that comes back to the mistrust and the suspicion. Yep. You've created a huge rupture and volatility in the family, and has upset all the expectations.
Yeah, so they're not seeing you as a person. They're seeing you as a less than the right kind of Mormon, right?
Yep, exactly.
And this, we do the same thing with race, right? We look at a person, we go, they're whatever color, and therefore we have all these kind of ideas about them, stereotypes, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a big call to get someone beyond that. And in my experience, the only way I can kind of get beyond that with Gina is because I really loved her. And I would say, it's not really hard to handle, but if they really loved you, they would see beyond that, but it will require you communicating with them, whether they're willing to communicate with you on that or not, I don't know. And once again, the why questions, right? You know, but it may just be something you feel. They're not actually saying it directly, so that, you know, it's that whole passive aggressive stuff that's going on. It's very difficult to get underneath. And I just think it's a case of, over time, them seeing that actually you're a good person and you're doing good things. I don't think there may not be an overnight fix to it.
Yeah.
And for some of them, they'll get on board with that sooner than others will.
It reminds me of like a situation we had recently. And I feel the same way. I'm like, don't you see that I am in this amazing space and God's speaking to me in different ways, and it's just opening up my vistas of, you know, spirituality. I'm finding new practices, and like, can't you respect that? And you're mostly not. And a couple of weeks ago, he came to church with me in the evening, and we'd sort of gone in there in a bit of a dudgeon, having an argument over about what, hypocrisy or something, I can't remember. And then the music started, and I'm like, just got myself carried away in the music, and he was still in my ear about hypocrisy. And I just said, you can't touch me now, I'm in my happy place.
I know what it was about.
No, you don't know. We don't need to talk about it. So what I'm going to say is that I trust the security that comes from finding new spiritual practices. I trust that. I trust that when I hear somebody say, I'm finding God in different ways, and I mean big God, whatever that is, I trust the spiritual direction. So that you just got to trust yourself and you and God in that journey, and trust that God's going to help you deal with the fear that's there. Yeah, but it is an evolution. It's a thing.
Something that Orthodox Mormons can relate to, of course, particularly if we've served missions, is we will have been in contact with people who joined the church, maybe from other churches, in which their families ostracized them, or maybe no church, but whatever the case, their families shut them off because they became Mormon, right?
Right.
And they'll often say, I don't understand it, because I'm a better person now than I was before, right? I used to smoke and drink, and I used to beat my wife or whatever, you know, and I don't do those things anymore. But they can't see that goodness. All they can see is I became a Mormon, right? So if opportunity emerges, that's a parallel analogy that many TBMs will be able to, I think, relate to. And maybe you can get some understanding out of that. I don't know.
Or it'll help me feel better.
Yeah. So, exactly.
Yeah. Look after you.
That's great advice.
Yeah. Don't beat your wife.
It looks like that's about it for today. And if you're not planning on sticking around for the next session, if you can just head out. Yeah.
Thank you.